For I would have you know, brothers and sisters, that the gospel that was proclaimed by me is not of human origin. It isn't. Nor, for I didn't receive it from a human source, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. That doesn't mean he didn't learn anything. He didn't know Jesus. He would have talked to Peter. We know he did. He would have talked to the people in Damascus. He learned a lot about Jesus from people. But his knowledge of Jesus came from an intimate experience of his. Is that any different for you? Where do we know anything from but from our own heart experience? People can tell us about things. They can't teach us. It has to come from engagement and so on. So without denying that he learnt, and of course he learnt a lot, and he'll tell us in other places he does. So, but where he learnt his gospel from, where he learnt to look at Jesus crucified from, where he learnt about God's love and the gift of himself that God is in love, where he learnt all that was in his prayer experiences with the mystery that we call God, a revelation of Jesus. He'll tell us in the Corinthians, have I not seen Jesus the Lord? And you know Luke's dramatization of this on the road to Damascus. It's three times in the Acts of the Apostles. So I'll take that as known by all. The gospel he taught came from God, and that's why he's preaching it. He goes on. You have heard, no doubt, of my earlier life in Judaism. I was violently persecuting the Church of God, Church of God. It's God's church. It's not our church. It's not his church. It's God's assembly, God's Kahal Yahweh, the community. I was trying to destroy it, he says. So if you're listening to all these people who've come round to Galatia with all this new knowledge about the Torah, where were they when the chips were down? Were they fighting the way I was for it? You see what he's doing? He's telling you he knows their scene. He was there doing it. And I advanced in Judaism beyond many among my people of the same age, for I was far more zealous for the traditions of my ancestors. I love the Torah too, he's saying. I loved it so passionately. I fought for it with all my energy of my youth. But when God, who had set me apart before I was born and called me through his grace, they're actually quotations from the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah uses the same image. It's a way of saying, well, he's linking himself with the prophets, the Jewish prophets. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 4 to 5, if you want the text. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1 and verse 5 to 6 use the same imagery. God said, in other words, this is what I was always meant to do. This was God's design for me. Called me through his grace. Here's the word again. When God was pleased to reveal his Son to me, so that I might proclaim him among the Gentiles, now we pause again. The Greek word here is en. Reveal his Son, en. Now, prepositions in all languages, if you think of English, if you ever have to teach English to a foreigner, they despair of our prepositions. Up to, you can use, they're not meaningless, but they've got such a complicated history. Prepositions like to and up, and I can't give you examples because they won't rush into my mind, but I'm sure you realise this. They're impossible for foreigners to learn because to doesn't always mean to, and in doesn't always mean in. It's very complex. So it is in Greek, particularly in the Greek spoken in the Hellenistic world, that is in the East. Because when you learn, when Greek is your native, your first language, you speak Greek. But when your first language is Syrian, Aramaic, or Egyptian, Coptic, in all the languages of the East, and you learn Greek as a second language for communication, trade, schooling, all that, when it's your second language, you know what you do. You use Greek, but from your own language base, you use it differently. People in India speak English different to people in England. People in anywhere else do too, because you're actually half-translating your idiom into the language that doesn't quite fit. Okay, you know that, and that's normal. It's the same. So the New Testament is all written in Greek as a second language. So it's got Hebrew idioms behind it. So with that in mind, you can't prove anything for the end, but others translated, including the great St. John Chrysostom back in the 5th century, he says, he was pleased to reveal his son in me. Very possible translation, and they not quite the same meaning. Eh? You can reveal, I can reveal something to you, or you can reveal it in you. You tell something to your children, you tell it to them, but people seeing your children see you in your children. In fact, sometimes to your horror, you see yourself in them. And mostly to your delight. but that's what happens. So the words have to be played with a little bit, and you're left with a little bit of unsurety, and they're both true. God revealed his son to Jesus, but he's also revealing his son in Paul. I mean, he's also revealing him in Paul to proclaim him among the Gentiles. That is Paul's basic mission. Keep watching, keep reading the Acts of the Apostles, keep reading Paul. It does not mean ever that Paul didn't preach to the Jews. It's not either or. In fact, Paul always went to the synagogue first. Of course he'd do that. He goes to the synagogue, and it's only when the synagogue rejects him that he goes out only to the Gentiles. The first Gentiles that Paul met were the Gentiles who used to come to the synagogue, and they did come to the synagogue, some of them. They're the first Gentiles he met, and then they told their friends. And that's why a lot of these letters written to Gentile communities, the Gentile community was already quite familiar with the Jewish Torah, because they'd learnt it at the synagogue. But they'd learnt it without having to become Jews. Do you see? And Christianity gave them a way of picking up all that they loved in Judaism without having to change their culture. That was one of its big attractions. Rightly so. And there's a lot you can read in the Acts, and if I had time I would read it to you, but I don't think I need to there. Now we come, I can't put it all on the overheads, you appreciate that, don't you? Otherwise it'd be too expensive for a start. So I'm now going to just read to you from my text, and you can read from your own, starting with chapter 1, verse 16. So that I might proclaim him among the Gentiles. I did not confer with any human being, nor, and this is his big point, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me, but, this was after his conversion at Damascus, I went away at once into Arabia. Arabia is what we would now call Jordan and south. Because most of Arabia then was uninhabitable except by people who had camels and, you know, like Bedouin groups. But basically it means that area of the world, south of Damascus. Afterwards I returned to Damascus. So he was in Arabia. Then after 3 years, he says, he's telling us his story. I did go up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas, Peter, his own, the Aramaic form of the name given to the words Jesus actually called him, Cephas, which in Greek is Petros, hence we call him Peter. But Jesus gave him the name Cephas or Cephas. I went to visit Cephas and stayed with him for a fortnight, for 15 days, but I didn't see any other apostle except James, the Lord's brother. So the point he's making is he had very little contact with the people in Jerusalem, so obviously they weren't the source of his gospel. He got information from them, of course, but it had to come from somewhere else. He was hardly there. He's talked about a visit that he made 3 years after his conversion. Well, if you look at the timeline that I gave you last week, I'm suggesting that was the year 37. Paul talks about his having to leave Damascus in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. We'll meet it later if you stay. About how he had to get into a basket and be let out because he was under his life was being threatened. And it's mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 9, how he was there and how he had the same story about getting in the basket and so on and having to go. So he's 3 years doing a missionary Gentile thing in Arabia. It doesn't seem to have been a very successful mission, which at least we know nothing about it, and nothing much came of it, and none of his letters were written there. So probably it was his first beginnings, and it wasn't, I don't know, I can't say any more about it. We don't know anything about it. He then went to Jerusalem, and we can read that in the Acts of the Apostles too, but he only saw Cephas and James, the Lord's brother. Let's spend a little bit of a minute on that. James, the Lord's brother. Not because it's, well, it is of some importance, so I'll just look at it here with you. Who are these people who are the brothers of Jesus? What do we know about them? In the Acts of the Apostles, we're told in chapter 1, verse 14, where they're gathering in the upper room, waiting for Pentecost, we're told the 11 were constantly devoting themselves to prayers together with certain women, including Mary, the mother of Jesus, as well as his brothers. Who were his brothers? Well, in the gospel itself, there's two possibilities. You know the scene where Jesus is there talking to the community and they come and say, your mother and brothers are outside, and Jesus replies, my mother and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do it. So brothers can mean male disciples. Sisters, female disciples. That's simple. It can't mean that in this up text here, because it's obviously more precise, because the 11 are brothers, aren't they? They're all brothers. So these seem to be a more specific group. So we might have to go to another scene in the gospel, which is at Nazareth, where Jesus goes home to his own hometown. It's mentioned the names are given in Mark and Matthew, and you read there they reject Jesus. By the way, they reject Jesus because he's too ordinary. That's a very important thing to note. They don't reject him because he's extraordinary. People love extraordinary things. They reject Jesus because, in a way, he's far too ordinary. They know him. They went to school with him. They played with him. They played soccer with him. They pulled kids, the girls' plaits with Jesus, and he probably was the leader of the group. I don't know what he did as a boy. He didn't sin. We know he was beautifully beyond sin, but children do a whole lot of things they have to learn that aren't sinful, but they mightn't be the best thing in the world, you know? I mean, it's learning. They're just children. How do they learn? How did Jesus learn? He's like us in everything except sin. Isn't this the carpenter, they said, the son of Mary, the brother, and now he mentions a few brothers. James, that's the James we're talking about here in this text, James, the brother, the Lord's brother. James and a few other names, Joseph, Judas and Simon, his sisters are here with us, etc. So who is this James? We'll just isolate him for a minute. How was he related to Jesus? We know he was the leading presbyter in the Jerusalem church. We find him at the Jerusalem, he's mentioned earlier here in chapter 12, he's also mentioned at the Council of Jerusalem. He's the one who finally gets up and makes the decision. He said, we've heard from Peter and we agree, and so we declare that. So he's the leader of the community, the overseer, the presbyter of that particular Jerusalem community, and we're told he's the Lord's brother. So we still have to work out who he was. Years ago, 25 years ago, I went up to Papua New Guinea to give a retreat to our priests and brothers and the nuns that were there, our own communities. And I have a brother, Jim, who's also in the parish with me now here. He's 10 years older than me. They all think he's younger, which tells me a lot about my age. But anyhow, he is older, and he was there in charge of the mission station, the priest there, and he introduced me to the people. And it's funny how some memories don't leave you. He said, oh, this is my brother Michael. And the people he was talking to said, same mother, same father? They wanted to know what he meant, because, of course, in their culture, with everybody living the extended family culture, the word brother covered half-brother, step-brother, cousin, you know, the whole, all the boys in the clan, in the group, family group. And when he said yes, then they were all over me because I was his brother and they loved him, so I got a bit by reflected radiance, as it were. But it's the same in the Aramaic culture, you see. They've got an extended family, so the word brother, it doesn't immediately tell you the relationship, it just tells you you're part of the family. So we have to see, have we any evidence in the New Testament that clarifies this for us, so that we might know whether it was another one of Mary and Joseph's children, or was it a cousin, or who was it, okay? We've got very little evidence, I'll give it all to you, and it all points in the same direction as the earliest tradition of the church, which from the grey things of oral tradition eventually emerges in the 3rd century, we hear it said, and there's never been any other tradition, was that Mary had only one child, and that was Jesus. That's our tradition. There's nothing to contradict it. And this certainly doesn't contradict it, for reasons I'll show you. And I promise not to spend much longer on this. Because we find out from Luke, who got his gospel from Paul, he talks about certain people, certain women, on the morning of the resurrection. It says Mary of Magdala was there, Joanna, Mary, another Mary, the mother of James, that's our James probably, and the other women who were there told them that the Lord had risen. So a Mary, just imagine it, the crucifixion has just happened, Jesus has just been buried, we're going to an empty tomb, and a woman there whose name is Mary is described in relation to someone who's off stage and in fact hasn't yet appeared in the gospel. Namely, James. This is James's mother I'm talking about, because Mary's very common. Mary was Moses' sister, Miriam. So every third girl's called Mary, okay? Like John, they're very common names. So this is the Mary he's talking about. I hope you can see that if James was actually Jesus' full brother, can't you see that the gospel writer, having been talking about Jesus for the whole chapter, in fact the whole gospel, would say Mary, the mother of Jesus. Not Mary, the mother of James. It's not the way you talk when you're writing. So it would seem to indicate that this James was not Jesus, Mary meaning Jesus' mother's child. That's what it would seem to me to be the case. And now quickly, at the foot of the cross, there were some women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Joseph, the two characters we saw there, and Salome. Once again, we've got Jesus on the cross dying, and the author of the gospel tells us that there was a woman there watching called Mary. Well, there's a few Marys, as you can see. One of them is Mary of Magdalene, but the other one is Mary the mother of James. Not the mother of Jesus. I'm not saying she wasn't there, but he doesn't talk. So, okay. Here's John standing near the cross of Jesus were his mother, his mother's sister, possibly Salome, Mary, a wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. You can see there are three Marys at the foot of the cross, so it's a very common name. But Mary, the wife of Clopas, seems to be Mary, the mother of James. If you just put the text together, it's very likely. And the last bit of evidence we have is that a bishop in the year 160 AD called Hegesippus says that Clopas was Joseph's brother, which would make this Mary, Jesus' mother Mary, her husband Joseph, Joseph's brother's wife. So it's sister-in-law of Mary, the mother of Jesus, which would make James Jesus' first cousin through the father's line. Okay? That's all the evidence we've got. It's perfectly consistent with our early tradition. Someone who quotes to you from the New Testament and says, there it says that Jesus had brothers and sisters, therefore Mary had other children. The logic is totally lacking from their argument. They just don't know enough to look at it properly. You'd have to say the New Testament doesn't answer the question. It's too vague to give us answer. The pointers go in that direction. And when that direction is uniformly the oral and then the written tradition of the early church, why wouldn't it be right? Verse 20 of chapter 1. So he saw James, the Lord's brother. In what I am writing to you before God, I do not lie. He's telling them, really, he knows what he's saying. So he only visited there twice before writing the Galatian story. Once for a fortnight, and then once on this journey that he took in down to Judea. The only two times he's ever even been near James or Peter are those two occasions. That's the point he's making here. He's surely right. He's not going to say something that's wrong and he forgot something. That's why I'm again suggesting to you, in the Acts of the Apostles, he visits there in, let's say, the year 37. He visits there with a famine relief in 47. And then he has a third visit, which is a longer one, at the Jerusalem Assembly. It's another pointer towards what I'm suggesting to you, that Galatians is written before his third visit. Then I went into the regions of Syria. The capital of Syria is Antioch, by the way. And Cilicia, the capital of Cilicia, is Tarsus, where he was born. So he goes back into those northern, into Turkey area. And I was still unknown by sight to the churches of Judea that are in Christ. He didn't spend time there. Some of them knew him as a persecutor, probably, but they never knew him as an apostle. They only heard it said that the one who formerly was persecuting us is now proclaiming the faith that he tried to destroy. The word faith is very important in Paul. I won't look at it now because I'll do it next week with you, God willing. And they glorified God because of me. That's the end of chapter 1. He's insisting on his authority because he wants them to believe the gospel for no other reason what authority's for. And he's saying, look, I have had very little contact with Jerusalem. So they're not the source of it. And so these people who are coming from Jerusalem, okay, that's not my source. I'm giving you something I know, yes, from God, from a revelation, from Jesus.